We were under this kind of Cold War environment, and suddenly everything was possible. The two Europes came together, and there were a lot of hopes for the future.
That was Stéphane Bussard talking about being an eyewitness to the fall of the Berlin Wall from the East German side. And you are listening to the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo, and if you've been here before, you know that I am your host, that this is my show, and that in each full episode, I sit down with interesting people. I use the lenses of risk, resilience, and randomness to explore all kinds of topics. Now, if you are new, here we go long form, and that means long conversations. We get to explore the nuance and the context of things, dive deep into topics, and on top of that, actually enjoy the conversation. I'm based in London in the UK, but my guests come from all over the world. Thank you to those who have been listening, and particularly to those who've left ratings or reviews on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. If you get the show on iTunes, there's several ways to get the show. iTunes is one of them, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, all other platforms are available. But if you get the show on iTunes, one of the things I've noticed is that there can be a bit of a delay from the time I post the episode to it showing up in the iTunes store. It doesn't mean that the episode isn't there, but to get it, the solution is you need to subscribe. If you subscribe, you'll get the show as soon as I post it. Sometimes the iTunes store can be a little bit quirky. Once again, a shout out to Andre Goritz, who is one of my listeners, who is currently embarking on a world record for the most amount of distance cycled in a single month in 30 days. And I believe he's on the home stretch now. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can track him. And as I've mentioned before, I'm hoping to get him on the show to talk about it. Today, we talk history, diplomacy, international politics, and the world of an international correspondent. My guest is Stéphane Bussard. Stéphane is the U.S. correspondent for Le Temps. Now, Le Temps is the leading French language newspaper in Switzerland. It's a world-class publication. Stéphane is Swiss. He was based in Geneva. He is now based in New York City, where he's been based in 2011. He has a very interesting background. And we start the conversation in late 1989, when he was on an exchange in Leipzig, Germany. That's in East Germany, if you recall. That is, or formerly known as the German Democratic Republic. And in November of 1989, the Berlin Wall and effectively the Iron Curtain came down. And guess what? Stéphane had not just a front row seat to this event, but he was effectively a participant in one of the monumental events of the history of the 20th century. And from that, I guess from randomly being in the right place at the right time, Stéphane was strongly influenced to become a journalist, an international journalist, a foreign correspondent. And we talk about that. It took him a good 10 years or so to get there, but he found himself at Le Temps, and he hasn't looked back since. He has covered some very interesting stories. He uncovered some secret talks between the U.S., Iran, and the EU that were taking place in Geneva in 2009 to, quote-unquote, avoid the worst. And as I mentioned, in 2011, Stéphane and his family moved to New York City as the publication's U.S. correspondent. And we have, I think, a fascinating conversation that covers Geneva and its role in diplomacy. It's a place that I have lived for 2.5 years. Stéphane actually wrote a book about the city of Geneva, both the international and the Swiss sides of Geneva. We talk about being a foreign correspondent in the United States. He's done some very interesting work, including tracing Barack Obama's origins and how all of that shaped him. We talk about Obama's legacy. We talk about Iran, Cuba. He's done, Stefan has done some very interesting work as well on the civil rights movement in the southern USA. And he's covered the Ferguson riots also, which was a very interesting part of the conversation. We talk a little bit about the US elections, the role of the media and journalism. I think it's a great conversation, and I think underlying all of it is something about the role of the individual and individual experiences in international affairs and ultimately history. I thoroughly enjoyed having Stefan on the show, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Stefan Bussard.
Soft start anyway, but first and foremost, just welcome to the show. thank you for joining me. I really wanted to get your perspective, get your views, because I think you have an interesting take on the world, and I thought that it would be good to have you on, so I wanted to thank you. But Stefan, maybe just first, for people that are listening, and I'm guessing that most of the people who are listening don't know who you are, but it'd be great if you maybe introduce yourself, a little bit of your background, and then we can take it from there.
Right. So I'm a Swiss reporter. I moved to journalism in 2000, and before that I was a translator. And if you want to know why I wanted to do journalism, it's actually linked to history in a way. It was always at the back of my mind, if you want, but in 1989, I had to spend a semester in a German-speaking country for my studies at the interpreting school in Zurich, and I chose to go to East Germany, and as you know, in 1989, something happened there. And being confronted with history, if you want, I really felt like starting to analyze things to try to understand better. And that's where actually I felt like becoming a journalist. I took up new studies in Geneva in international relations to have some kind of background that would allow me to better understand the world. And it took me something like 10 years since I wanted to become a journalist, and I became one, you know.
That's interesting. I'd like to just maybe go back to 1989 and maybe just get your views on what you were. Where in East Germany were you?
I was in Leipzig because one of my professors had contact with the University of Leipzig, and and it was a unique opportunity to go on the other side of the wall to see if the grass was greener or not, and I was ready to anything. So, but I didn't know it would move that way. You know, it was amazing.
And what was it like when the wall and effectively the Iron Curtain came down? From that, you were there during that time, right? In November.
So when we learned that on TV, we were in Leipzig, obviously, and we were talking with foreign students and also East German students, and the East German students wouldn't believe what was happening. So we were celebrating, but we were mostly foreign journalists, foreign students. And the day after that, we took the first train to Berlin because we knew they would open a border post, things like that. So we went there and we had an amazing weekend there. You know, a lot of people crossing the border for the first time to the west. And it was a feeling that it's very hard to describe, since we were under this kind of Cold War environment, and suddenly everything was possible. The two Europes came together, and you know, there were a lot of hopes for the future.
Mm-hmm. So it must have been also a big big party atmosphere as well. I would have thought.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There were, I don't remember, but 2 million people in East Berlin or in Berlin during the whole weekend. And when we wanted to go back to Leipzig, the trains were totally packed. It was it was crazy, absolutely crazy. And people were so enthusiastic about what was going on, you know. And yeah, it was a very, very, very emotional moment, I must say.
So you clearly witnessed history. I mean, I think it's very it's amazing now to think that that Europe was that divided. But it, you know, I grew up during the Cold War as you did, and it was a monumental occasion. So I can certainly see how that affected your decision to become a journalist. But it took you some time. Did you just try to keep at it and keep the dream going, or did you?
I knew why I took up new studies, and it was really because I wanted to become a journalist. But obviously the circumstances weren't too good at the time. You know, newspapers were rather laying off people than hiring people. Mm-hmm. So I did other jobs as well in between, and then when I heard that the situation looked better, then I took my chance and it worked out.
Great. Okay. So you're currently based in the U.S. and you're effectively the foreign correspondent for Le Temps, which is, I guess, the leading French-speaking newspaper in Switzerland.
That's right.
And you've been with Le Temps throughout your journalistic career. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been working for Le Temps for 16 years now. Mm-hmm.
And before moving to the U.S., you spent you're Swiss. You're from Clier, right?
Exactly.
Where the cheese comes from.
That's right.
So, but you were in Geneva working for Le Temps for a number of years before moving across to the U.S. What were some of the things that you got involved in? Because Geneva, I lived there, as you know, for 2.5 years or so, and it's actually a very interesting place because all of the international organizations, and if you're into international relations, then it is a fascinating place. So I would imagine some of the things you got involved in were fairly interesting. What were some of the highlights of your early days as a journalist?
That's right. What I tried to do is actually to tell both tales of the town, because I started to cover local politics for 5 or 6 years, and it was very interesting to see what matters in terms of local politics, what impact it has on people and things like that. So I think it was quite interesting. And then I moved on to the international section, covering also international Geneva and things like that. So I could see both sides of the city. So it was quite enjoyable. And I learned a lot about that. I could also speak about the interaction or lack thereof between the two Geneva.
I mean, it's having lived there, there are really two Genevas. There is the international Geneva and Swiss Geneva, and it is remarkable. What's important to Swiss Geneva?
It's a very very particular. What you call province in Canada, but is a canton in Switzerland. It's very close to the French border, so it has a lot of French influence in Geneva. But you also have, as you said, international influence. But the Swiss Geneva is, on one hand, wants to be very different from other Swiss cantons, but on the other hand, being at the extreme bit of Switzerland, and you know, extreme end of Switzerland, it really wants to show that it does belong to the country, and is committed to belonging to this bigger thing, which is Switzerland. Mm-hmm.
And I think you got as you moved into the international side, you got involved in some interesting stories. If I'm not mistaken, Stefan, I'm sure you would have. But what were some of the more interesting stories that you covered while you were doing you were looking at the international side?
I would mention two stories. Maybe one was actually secret talks between Iran and the U.S., or I should put it in a different way, between academic people and professors and experts from Iran, from the U.S., in a format which is called Track 2. So it's not a direct diplomacy, mm-hmm. but it's a second-tier diplomacy, if you want. Mm-hmm. And that was very exciting because I could take advantage of the network I had built up in Geneva with the Iranian community, with the international community as well. And that's how I could come up with this story, which was a kind of scoop. And I think I learned a lot. I had also to, you know, it was a very sensitive story. So I, for example, when I wrote my story, I had to keep some information. I didn't publish everything I had because I had, for example, to protect people in Iran who could have had problems if I had revealed all the information I had, things like that. So that was an exciting story, and especially due to the fact that we were in the middle of, you know, kind of negotiations between Iran and the international community about the Iran nuclear program. Was the very beginning of the negotiation. It didn't work very well at the time, and so it was quite exciting to see that. And it was also during the Ahmadinejad's presidency in Iran, and we know that he was quite conservative and not very fond on cooperation, international cooperation, like the current president Hassan Rouhani. And that was one story. The second story was also about kind of talks between Russia and the U.S. Mm-hmm. I call this story was the Chambezi talks. Chambezi is in the suburb of Geneva. And actually it was in 2010, and it was a time where the U.S. and Russia were trying to cooperate, and they did actually under the Obama and Medvedev presidencies. And what was quite interesting is that this cooperation led, in a way, to a breakthrough with the New START treaty on the reduction of strategic arms, and that was quite interesting. So interesting. I came up with this story, and we didn't know that those kind of talks were taking place in Geneva to try to foster cooperation between the two countries. And it was a time where NATO, for example, was thinking of, you know, really developing the partnership with Russia. Russia was invited to the NATO summit in Portugal and things like that. That was an exciting story to write.
In terms of developing these stories or researching them, what goes into something like that? How long does that take for either of those two stories?
Mm-hmm. I think I would rank those stories in the section of investigative journalism.
Yes.
And so it takes some time. You shouldn't be too much in a hurry to publish it, because you always need something more and more. And you have a first contact, and but you know that that gives you feel like investigating more and more. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it takes some time to be able to write the story you really want to publish. Because it doesn't make sense to try to publish that as soon as possible, you know. And obviously it takes time. You have to wait. Sometimes you can't contact such a person, and you need some more time. So, you know, it could take 1 or 2 months to finish the story.
In either of those two cases, what What really stood out or surprised you as you worked on it? I guess, you know, just thinking about what the environment in Geneva is like. I mean, there are talks and there are things, you know, there are informal negotiations and all kinds of things that are going on. I mean, it's the only place that I can think of where you could walk down the street and see you know, a delegation from North Korea, as happened to, you know, to me with their Kim Il-sung badges, you know, and asking you for directions in the street. It's a place probably where there are, you know, there are lots of things that are going on that aren't open, but are also very important. What surprised you as you worked on either of those two stories, or any of the stories that you worked on in your time there?
Mm-hmm. What struck me is the fact that obviously you have, even though you might have very high tensions or very strong tensions between countries and things like that, you see, you meet a lot of people who really want to cooperate, to move forward, to try to go beyond the you know, usual tensions or you know, disagreements and things like that. So. And I think Geneva, in this sense, is still a very interesting spot, because it's not burdened by ideology or by the past. Switzerland has never been a colonial power or whatever. So it sounds, as you may know, pretty neutral, and it does help countries. You know, try to negotiate on very sensitive issues there.
Yes.
You know,
it plays a very important place in the world. No question about it. It's hard to have these kinds of conversations in any. You know, it's hard to imagine these kinds of conversations in any other environment. And you know, the uproar. Oh, I can't believe that our government is doing this or talking to these guys. Mm-hmm. It makes it very difficult to have progress diplomatically.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's interesting. And you also wrote a book during your earlier days in journalism. What was that about?
Yeah, I wrote a book about that was when I was covering Geneva politics, local politics, and I wrote a book about it. And after having covered that for 5 to 6 years, and I said I thought it would be great to have a different take on things. Not that I didn't write things that I was I felt like writing, you know, but obviously journalism is a certain way of writing, and writing a book is different. You get more personal, you know, and that was actually the thing I wanted to do before moving to something else, you know. I think it was a very interesting experience, because I had a lot of interaction after writing this book with local politicians and people who, you know, who agreed or disagreed, but didn't matter. It created a debate about what was Geneva all about, the problems it was facing and at the time. And actually, some people tell me now that I could write the same book today, which doesn't really please me, because I'd rather see Geneva moving forward.
What was the main premise of the book? The main message?
The main message is that Geneva has a lot of assets and qualities and things like that, but for ideological reasons and for, you know, their partisanship, it has been unable to move beyond all those kind of traditional cleavage and differences, you know. And it's a shame, because I think, for example, I'll give you an example. One of my chapter was focused on housing, and we know that Geneva is an international city or town, but it's not really able to welcome so many people because they haven't built enough houses and things like that. And that's due to a very strong partisanship, and they're unable to agree on what to do, where to build, and things like that.
Okay. Okay, well, interesting, but but perhaps disappointing that that things haven't moved on. Okay. Well, I'd like to turn to your time in the U.S. So you, I guess, did you decide to move to the U.S. and cover the United States, or were you assigned there? Was it a little bit of both? Where was the interest coming from?
It really came from me, because I was already a candidate for a position in London, and by the time they accepted me, they suppressed the position, so I had to wait some time before moving to something else. And when the opportunity came up, I candidated, and I don't regret it, because I think it was a great, it has been a wonderful experience.
Can you give us a flavor of what it's like to be a foreign correspondent in the United States? So looking at the United States from Swiss eyes, what does that entail? What is your access like to, you know, the leadership, or the, you know, the movers and shakers in the United States? What are the kinds of things that you cover? What is that, you know, what is that like?
Yes. So obviously, when you arrive, the first thing you have to do is to start building up a network of experts, of people you know, and can give you some kind of insight in what's going on in the U.S. So it takes you some months to do that. And as far as access is concerned, obviously, the foreign press doesn't have much access to Congress. For example, I did interview one or two senators or things like that, or congressmen, but they're not totally interested in what foreign press think about politics. So that's a bit difficult. But on the other hand, I think Americans otherwise are extremely accessible. I've been talking a lot to experts, to people working in think tanks in Washington or in New York or elsewhere in the country, and I think where we don't have this kind of hierarchical kind of barrier that prevents you from, you know, accessing people. I've been talking to people even in the State Department or things like that, or former officials of different administrations. As a journalist, it's a very interesting ground to work, you know, to work in. I think it's easy for a journalist to work here. And as far as access to people in general, I think I compare that to Switzerland, where people are more reserved when you bump into them on the street and things like that. Here it's different. I think people like to tell their own story, and so wherever I travel around the country, I always meet people who really feel like talking, and so for a journalist, it's a great thing, you know, because you always like when people tell their own story.
Yeah, I think Americans are known to be fairly forthcoming, sometimes overly so, but I'd be keen to get some highlights from you as well around, you know, some of the most interesting stories that you've worked on in your time in the U.S.
I would mention two or three stories. One of them was early in my stay here in New York. It was in 2012. I went to Hawaii, actually. Wow. I could convince my newsroom to send me there because it was for a summer series. So, you know, you write stories which are a little bit different. We are not linked to any breaking news or things like that. So I went there to write a story about on the footstep of President Obama.
Right.
Because he spent all together something like 15 years in Hawaii. So it must have some kind of influence on the person. So I went there. I met a lot of former roommate, former classmates, former professors. I talked to his sister or half-sister, if you want. And that was a way to write a story about President Obama under a more humane point of view. And I found it quite interesting. And I wrote other stories about Hawaii, but I just to talk about the story which I found more interesting.
What were some of the highlights of how that time in Hawaii shaped Obama? I'll certainly put the links, by the way, to all of your pieces in the show notes of the show. Not everyone will be able to, I think, necessarily read French, but you know, I'll put them all there for people. But you know, just in case, what were some of the things that you took away from that impressed you?
I would say maybe three things. First, he had a hard time during his youth there in terms of identity, you know, because his father was not present. He left very early when he was very young. He just saw him a few times. And his mother was also, when they moved to Indonesia for some years, and he came back by himself. He was raised mostly by his grandfather and grandmother. Mm-hmm. And so he had to struggle in terms of identity, and that's basically where he decided to become to identify to the African American culture in a way. And I think that was, and he did that also through, for example, basketball. He used to play a lot of basketball there, and I think it was it explains why he now is. He speaks the way he does in terms of racial tensions and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we, mm-hmm. and the other thing that struck me was the fact that we haven't often heard about President Obama being a very cold president, not engaging socially with people and things like that. And when I went there, I discovered that it's not exactly him, you know. The people who knew him at the time found him very social, very, you know, very forward-coming, and a nice guy, and very also thoughtful, and he was also, I think he always participated in debates at school, and mostly listening to people before intervening, you know.
Yeah. I think that Obama is going to have a wonderful time, or is going to enjoy a lot more life outside of the White House than he has inside. And I think you can start to see that. I think he's going to be a very interesting former president as well as a current one. I don't know if you get that sense. So.
Absolutely. And then maybe just the last point about my trip to Hawaii. I think you could also see that he had a different vision of the world. And I think the fact that he was born on a Pacific island shaped a little bit his vision of the world as well. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he came up with this Asian pivot, knowing that the world economy is moving towards Asia and things like that. And I think that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, interesting. That sounds like a fascinating story to have worked on.
We'll
certainly put that in the notes of the show.
I would come up maybe with another story, which I also wrote for a summer series that was in 2014, and that was for the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act in the U.S. And so I took advantage of this anniversary to go reporting to Alabama, Mississippi about the civil rights, in the light of today, how have things changed, and to what extent we still have problems or whatever. So I went to Selma, Alabama, to meet people who had participated in the march through the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and I also met a reverend who was in the same cell as Martin Luther King Jr. He talked about that. I went then to Mississippi to talk about people who were there at the time of the riot in 1962, where those riots were provoked by the fact that the Supreme Court imposed the accept the admission of the first African-American student there, and people were not very happy with that. Kennedy had to send the National Guards to end those kind of riots. And I met actually the first African-American student. He's still alive, and I met him, and he talked about the events at the time, and he talks about his life afterwards. And that was quite interesting. And then also, it was a full week series of articles. And so I also interviewed a Broadway show director who had put on a show, a theater play about Lyndon Johnson, the president. And I found very interesting to see why he wanted to do that, and to what extent is Lyndon Johnson still pertinent today, it was a very, very compelling story.
Yeah, interesting. Just a couple of thoughts. I mean, what one is just, I think that our experiences certainly shape our, it sounds obvious, but, when you talk about Obama and identifying, very strong, much more strongly with, his African American side or his African side, as well as the pivot to Asia, our circumstances really affect decisions, much like your time in East Germany during the time of during the fall of the Berlin Wall, how that affected you. And I think those are the really interesting stories that that journalists can tell, it's not just stories, and there's a richness that I think comes out in very good journalism, good investigative journalism. It doesn't necessarily have to be coming up with the big scoop, but it can be unpicking some of these personal stories, and I think that's must be a fascinating side of the work that you do. But it sounds, well, to me, it would certainly be. It sounds really interesting. Did you get any sense of, you've been in the U.S. for a few years. What about the when you compare, when you take a look at your civil rights piece and what's been happening more recently, things like Ferguson and the racial tensions that we hear about, how much has moved on, and how much do you think has not moved on?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because when I came up with my series, there wasn't so much going on the racial front, if you want, and it started then, and so it was pure coincidence. That said, what I would say about that is that a lot of people said, oh, now we have an African-American president, so he's going to solve the racial problem and things like that. So obviously it was a bit naive to think that. And what I think the Obama administration has been doing is that it has kind of revealed the remaining racial problems that exist here in the U.S. And in revealing it, it will help the country maybe move forward, because what came out since 2012, for example, is that we saw a lot of police shooting of African Americans and under very kind of dubious circumstances and things like that. And I met actually a mother of Jordan Davis, who was shot by a white man, and she told me the story of gun control. Now she's really working to try to move on in terms of tightening gun controls and things like that. So whole story. I went to Ferguson as well to cover the protests and things like that. So obviously, what came out in the last three, four, 5 years is that we really saw, obviously, very, very clearly that there are still racism, and I would put it put it that way. What I discovered in the South, in Mississippi, Alabama, is that those states have moved a lot forward in terms of getting rid of the old Jim Crow era and things like that. But, for example, I don't say that there's no longer individual racism, but now the real problem is more institutional racism, you know, that remains in policing, in the U.S. prison system, in the U.S. justice system. Obviously, you have a lot of black people who are still in jail for very low crime, low, you know, petty crimes and things like that. But in, and they were jailed because of the kind of war on drug at the time of, in the 90s and things like that. And so... And I think what actually Obama has been doing is he was maybe very discreet in the first man during his first man term because he did he really wanted to be the president of all Americans, which he still is, but he didn't dare you move too far away too much in this in supporting blatantly, you know, the African American community, because he didn't want to. He was already struggling with the Republicans and not really cooperating with him to pass, for example, the health care reform or other other bills. So yes, I think. There's still a lot of work to be done, but the Obama administration, in this sense, has revealed a lot of things, and I think now people are more aware of what needs to be done.
Yeah. What do you think his legacy will end up being?
In general.
In general, yeah.
Yeah. I personally think the Obama presidency will be seen in history in a very, in a much more positive way than we might think today, because even though there was a lot of expectations in 2008 when he was elected, and over expectation in Europe, for example, people were thinking that he would totally transform the U.S. Obviously, you don't transform a world power like this in just one presidency. But at the end of the day, if you count his promises and the one he kept quite a lot, even though some of them were not kept because of maybe he didn't push hard enough. But on the other hand, there's never been a president with so much obstructionism from Congress. It's unheard of what happened during his presidency. And the leader of the Republican in the Senate, as I had said on the very first day of his presidency, he's going to be a one-term president. And obviously, they did everything possible to try to block his project and things like that. So as far as the healthcare reform is concerned, I think obviously it's not perfect, because you don't change a healthcare system with just one law, and there are flaws, probably things like that. But I think it was a major move forward in the U.S. context, and I think the fact that we have now 20 more million people insured is a progress. Obviously, U.S. still have 29 million people not insured, because you know, the Supreme Court didn't allow the automatic extension of the Medicaid in the states. So, but that's a major success, I would say. Mm-hmm. Then, in terms of foreign policy, I think what we did achieve with the nuclear deal, I think it's also a major breakthrough. We'll have to see if it's going to be implemented properly, if it will work very well. But I think it was the best solution at the time, and I think the fact that President Obama was ready to talk to the enemy, the arch enemy, I think was pretty significant. And I think those negotiations, which started really seriously under the Rouhani presidency in Oman, were very impressive, and I think we did everything possible to try to move that forward, and eventually it worked out for different reasons. And I think that's going to be, if if the agreement is really well implemented, it's going to be a major break, a major achievement. I would also talk about Cuba, because Cuba is also something that I found quite compelling. The U.S. has been imposing a commercial embargo for 60 years, since 1962, and obviously it hasn't produced the effects they wanted to have. It has rather, I would say, confirmed in a way the Castro in you know, they stayed in power for more time than they maybe should have if there were no embargo. And now the fact that he opens up to Cuba and that he worked with Raul Castro to reestablish diplomatic relations, I think that's the right way to deal with it, because I think the more, and the logic of the Obama administration is to say, the more you expose Cuban people to the outside world, the more it's going to move forward. And I think I think it was a major breakthrough too. And the fact that he went to Cuba as a first president since Coolidge in 1928 was also quite significant. And I remember reading editorials by U.S. newspapers saying, oh, but if he goes there not talking about human rights and not meeting with dissidents, it's going to be an ignoble failure. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I think it was he held there a very forceful speech, and which Cubans received very well, mostly Cuban people. And I think change will take time to in Cuba, but I think that was a very good thing to do.
Yes, that certainly was a marked shift in U.S. foreign policy, and we'll see what transpires. But yeah, those were certainly bold moves if you think about historically in U.S. foreign policy. It seemed for a time that Obama didn't really have a foreign policy to me, but I think he has come through with a number of interesting things. We'll see how they pan out. One of the things I did want to talk about, and I told you at the beginning that I didn't really want to date my interview with you, in that we talk about something that in 6 weeks' time will be sort of out of date. But I think that this part is not necessarily something that's very short term, and that's just around the level of dissatisfaction that people have with politics and the indifference that people have with politics. I think it's very pronounced in the U.S. Not just dissatisfaction or indifference, but actually quite visceral reactions. And I'm thinking about the popularity of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. But I think in other parts of the world, we see this as well. In the UK here, we've got Brexit, and I think a lot of the Leave campaign is all about just disaffection with the process and with politicians in general. There's a lack of authenticity with I think a lot of leaders, and people almost expect politicians to lie in elections and then turn around and break the promises when they get elected, and I think that's what's driving the popularity of both Sanders and Trump, because you've a couple of candidates that seem to say what's on their mind, and people value that, whether or not either of them will end up with nominations. Trump looking more likely at the time of writing in the Republican camp, but I don't know what your thoughts or reactions are, but I think people are incredibly frustrated with the way their leaders act and speak and how they are.
You're right. I think it's very pronounced here in the U.S., as you said, with the Trump and Sanders phenomenon. I think that's a key feature of this electoral campaign. And as you said, there's a lot of anger for different reasons. I would say first, for example, Trump is really tapping into an electorate that is feels disenfranchised and actually battered in a way by the globalization, mostly white working class people, who either lost their job or have very low paid wages because of the manufacturing kind of I would say, degradation of the manufacturing industry and things like that. And well, that's, and these people, they're even more angry at Washington because they see that Congress has been blocking everything, that Congress and White House were unable to work together, that politicians were mostly working for their own interests. We know that in Congress, half the people are millionaires, and which they are not when they're elected there, but they become millionaires afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so, and you have, we're also aware of the fact that lobbies play a very important role in Washington. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one of the reasons why the Bernie Sanders phenomenon comes up, because before him, you had some kind of movement which was not totally political, but Occupy Wall Street in 2011, just before the 2012 election, was quite a significant movement, but it didn't translate into a political movement. And I think Bernie Sanders, in a way, succeeded in tapping into this. And I think there's still a lot of anger at Wall Street, at, you know, at the role that banks played during the financial crisis in 2011, 9 and 10. And obviously, you know, the U.S. taxpayer had to bail out banks, even though they were partially responsible for the mess, you know, of this financial crisis with the subprime and things like that. So, but that's a phenomenon that we see in a lot of different countries. And I think this populism is also a new kind of sign that democracies are, it's not something we can take for granted. It has to be defended all the time. It's you know, you have principles that you have to stick to, and it takes a lot of energy and things like that. And we see that now liberal democracies are struggling, obviously. Because the party system is not working well either, you know, the extreme partisanship of Washington has been devastating, you know, because they're not, you people have the impression that the politicians are not working in the interest of the country, but, you know, of their own party or of themselves. And I think, for example, as far as Trump is concerned, we don't care anymore whether Trump tells the truth or if he bases his speech on facts. It doesn't matter. We just want someone who is not part of the political establishment, but is not, you know, is not one of them, and we were happy that he is very brutal in the way he describes things, and even though he doesn't have a real program or necessarily a vision of what needs to be done. But, you know, the simple is a medium. The message is a medium, if mm-hmm. you want. Mm-hmm. And as far as Sanders is concerned, it's slightly different because I think he puts his fingers on a lot of problems that do that are real in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But the problem he faces, obviously, is a practicality. Would he be able to implement what he's talking about? It's a big problem, and electability as well. And most people think he's not necessarily electable.
Yeah, I think your point about you know, taking democracy for granted is an interesting one, and we also have a lot of self-censorship. I can see from stories coming out about, you know, what people can say in universities, for example, or and it's something that is happening in the UK and Canada to an extent, but that's also an interesting, you know, an interesting phenomenon around almost self-censorship, safe spaces, and things like this. It's it is an interesting time, but free speech and democracy are a little bit under a lot of strain at the moment, or not a little bit, but it seems like they are a lot under strain, and just from what I can see, a lack of authenticity on the part of leaders, that, and people take that as a default position, which is it certainly is worrying. So I did want to I want to get closer to wrapping up, but I wanted to talk about maybe some bigger picture things as well, Stefan. One is just around the craft of being a journalist in this day and age of social media. And, you know, we've got people blogging and tweeting and all kind of sometimes all kind of ridiculous things. When you watch one of these news, 24-hour news programs, and you've got the interview, and then you've got stock, prices on the bottom, and you've got tweets flashing, and you mm-hmm. have all kind of distractions. Is anyone mm-hmm. really saying anything? Sometimes, you know, where's the meat on the stories and the insights? It sometimes does feel like you're struggling, or we are struggling. As a journalist, have you seen, has this affected how has social media and the sort of fast moving way in which we get information, has it affected the way you work from when you started until now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously, yes, digital era has changed a lot of things in the media industry, and a lot of people are struggling because they don't know exactly what to do, how to to balance the online edition, the print edition, and things like that. And social media has obviously play a major role because you can't just focus your work on what's going on in the print edition or on your own website. You need to be referred to in social medias and things like that. But what I would say is that, as you said, you see a lot of different things as far as quality is concerned. You see very good pieces through social media, but you see also very, very, very weak kind of pieces of journalism. And that's a problem, because I think nowadays, as we were talking about democracies being weakened in a way, you would need some stronger kind of journalism. Mm-hmm. And I think it's still possible, obviously, in the digital era. I think you still see a lot of good things. But the problem is that now you have to reinvent all possible models. You don't have a clear, sustainable model for medias, and so now everybody tries to invent its own model, and it means that you have also to look for different kind of sources of funding and crowdfunding, things like that. So it's going to change. It has changed a lot, but it's going to change even more in the next years. But it's a struggle. Even to do probably quality journalism, it's going to be a struggle, mm-hmm. because of the funding, because of the overflood of news, of things like that. But I'm sure if you come up with a quality journalism project or things like that, or you still insist on doing real journalism, I'm sure it's still possible to do that.
And, I agree. Yeah.
Yes, but I social media in a way I do use personally social media, and I think it's useful to because it helps me also in terms of a search engine in a way. Mm-hmm. It helps me mm-hmm. find a lot of different things I would never find otherwise, and to get in touch with people I would probably not reach or whatever. And but then I don't also lose too much time just tweeting or things like that, because that's not necessarily very substantial. But yes.
Yeah, I think there are a number of things going on. I mean, one is that we do have all of this information, but which isn't necessarily insider knowledge, but we have much more information. But on the other hand, I think there are, as you say, social media is very useful, and mm-hmm. we have all these other sources of interesting stories and things that are popping up, whether it's an online magazine or YouTube or different sources of information now, and we can pick and choose, which is good and bad. I mean, I think it's good in a way where you can get lots of interesting stories. I mean, this podcast podcasts, for example, and other podcasts are ways in which people can get perspectives that they wouldn't necessarily have. But on the other hand, I think for others, it's a bit of an echo chamber. You can just get the sources that kind of confirm your own biases, and you just repeat them. So it is an interesting time. I agree. I think quality journalism will probably always come through, but maybe the vehicle will be a little bit different.
That's right. We'll and see. the increase of the fact that you have far more information now that increases in a way the necessity to go back to the basic of journalism, double checking information, things like that. And obviously, you have such a flood of information which are not necessarily double checked and things like that.
Yes.
So anything on social media, and sometimes you had really bad things coming up, you know, things that were not confirmed, but were, you know, and they're all over the place, all over the world in a few seconds. So I think, the need to go back to the basic of journalism is absolutely necessary and even more emphasized today with social media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is. It does make for a more dynamic landscape. Just a couple of more things before we wrap up, Stefan. One was just around. So you're just going back to 1989 or even before. But you know, when you looked at the state of the world, I kind of see you as an optimist in terms of how you view things. I'm wondering what maybe some of your bigger sort of hopes for things to improve in. And I think, generally speaking, things are a lot better in so many ways in our global economic and political space. But what are some of the things that you're hopeful for over the coming, say, 5 or 10 years, and maybe things that you're concerned about?
Yeah, I think temperamentally, I'm definitely optimistic, and but I must say I've been a little bit disappointed by the evolution of what's going on the international stage. I said, going back to 1989, I was kind of amazed by what was happening. I was full of hopes, obviously it was the end of the Cold War, and now I was a bit disappointed by what happened with the return of some kind of Cold War between Russia and the U.S. and by what's going on in the Middle East and then sometimes you try to understand what's going on with terrorism becoming a much bigger issue worldwide and things like that. But I still believe that cooperation, basic principle of, cooperation, diplomacy, and things like that still, in my opinion, still brings a better good than just brutal military intervention or things like that. It's, for example, there's a big debate about the so-called Arab Spring and, should we have intervened, should we have supported, the dictators of the time, Mubarak or Ben Ali and things like that, because given the mess we're in now, and I personally think, how can you kind of tell people who are protesting on the street of Cairo that, democracy is not for you. We're going to keep supporting your dictator or things like that. And in this sense, it's a tragedy what's going on now in certain countries after the Arab Spring. But on the other hand, this aspiration for democracy and things like that, or for freedom and things like that, you can just, kill this hope and it should remain there. And so I still remain optimistic. But what happened between Iran and the U.S., what between Cuba and the U.S., I'm focusing here on the U.S. because I've been here for 5 years, but I could extend that to different other issues worldwide. We live in a globalized world, and that's everything is interconnected now. That's in a way it's it might be worrying for people who lose their job, but on the other hand, it's fascinating because you see a lot of people who see things the way you do, or they don't, but they do want to communicate with you, and this kind of global interaction is fascinating, and I think we're getting closer and closer together, and hopefully it's going to be for the better.
Great. Well, that sounds that does sound hopeful, Stefan. I guess just one last question would be, if you were to be able to give yourself some advice, to the 20-year-old Stefan, what knowing what you know now, what might be some of the things you would say?
I think there's a lot of pessimism about journalism today, about, you know, the industry is suffering, is struggling with, there are media which don't really do their job properly and things like that. But on the other hand, if you feel like, you know, doing this job, if you feel like trying to analyze what's going on in the world also on a local basis, because local journalism is also as important as covering international news, because that's what exactly a democracy is all about. You have to question the institution also on a local basis. So if you feel like doing that, I think there are still a lot of opportunities. I'm sure there will be new media in the future as well, new form of media, you know, whatever. And it's still in big need, because as I said, institutions need to be questioned. People need to understand better what's going on, because there's such a flood of information. Sometimes it's very hard to distinguish between the news you get and things like that. So yeah, if you want to do that, try to get the best possible background. Try to then contact, you know, even local media. Start at the bottom maybe, but you learn the work, you know, the job. I had the opportunity, it's a great opportunity to learn the job with a fantastic guy who taught me so much that I still benefit from this kind of training I had. And I think, I would, if somebody wants to become a journalist today, even he's 20-year-old and the industry doesn't look good, I would still go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Great. That sounds like sage advice, Stefan. Okay, well, I think we covered quite a lot of ground, so I just wanted to thank you for coming on. And where can people find you on social media or other sources if they're interested in following your work? Where can they find you?
Yeah, mostly Twitter, Twitter or LinkedIn, but Twitter, Twitter, and
What's your Twitter account handle or Twitter name?
It's a Bussard, BUSSARDS.
Okay, perfect. Okay, I'll put the links to all of that on the show notes so people can go and check those out. Stefan, this was really fascinating. I enjoyed this a lot. So thank you for coming on, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you so much, Ivan.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was a great conversation, I thought. And one of the things that I took away was that, you know, even in the realm of geopolitics and international diplomacy, foreign affairs, etc., systemic thinking, all this stuff that I well and truly love and am fascinated by, the role of individual experiences, and much like Stefan himself, the role of individual experiences matters a huge amount, and that we mustn't lose sight of that. If you enjoyed the conversation, check out Stefan, check out his stories. Now, they are written in French, but you can use this as an opportunity to either brush up or learn French, or what the hell, plug them into Google Translate and see what comes out the other end. But do check them out. I highly encourage you to do that. Stefan writes very well, and he's a great journalist. I hope you enjoyed the show. The show will always be free of charge I'll never charge for the content, but one of the things I do ask is that if you enjoy the episodes, that you please share, subscribe, and in particular, leave a rating or a review on iTunes or wherever you get the show. Also, leave me some feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place that you can grab hold of me. You can follow me on Twitter, at RiskThings is the handle. And you can check out allthingsrisk.com, which is the website. We'll be back soon with some more great episodes, so stay tuned. And in the interim, don't forget, risk is life.